Okay, well, in classical or traditional political thought, the state is seen as a sovereign power that stands above society in order to prevent a war of all against all, to put it in the terminology that Hobbes used. And so in this analysis, the state can be more or less efficient, can be more or less rational, but overall, it's vitally necessary to the smooth and orderly running of society. This is really what makes up the mainstream liberal view, small-l liberal view, today. Society is seen as being made up of different classes, interest groups, and so on, and the state is a neutral body that exists above all of that, reconciling those interests in the greater good. So laws are created only with the equal application of justice in mind. Parliament is the ultimate arbitrator. It's an unbiased reflection of popular will, and the army, of course, is there for the defence of the nation and to protect our safety. So this worldview allows for states to be more or less corrupt, more or less dictatorial, more or less democratic. And so this is why these liberals argue for checks and balances. So, you know, the separation of powers, for instance. This kind of worldview allows for reformers to win control over certain aspects of the state. But, of course, the checks and balances prevent, you know, any dramatic change from happening too quickly, because heavens knows we wouldn't want any rapid change. So within this ideological framework, the sort of pro-capitalist thinkers conduct debates as to the relative weight that the state should have. Neoliberals, for instance, who are rapidly declining in both fame and prestige, always argued for a smaller, less interventionist state. That is to say, the state and the neoliberal worldview would just defend the law and national security and leave the rest to business. On the other hand, traditional liberals or social democrats in the Kevin Rudd vein, for instance, are defenders of an interventionist state. And Rudd's recent essay in the Monthly magazine makes this case quite stridently. He wrote, "With the demise of neoliberalism, the role of the state has once more been recognised as fundamental. The state has been the primary actor in responding to three clear areas of the current crisis: in rescuing the private financial system from collapse, in providing direct stimulus to the real economy because of the collapse in private demand, and in the design of a national and global regulatory framework regime in which the government has ultimate responsibility to determine and enforce the rules of the system." So, you know, as is reasonably clear, this side of the debate is coming back into fashion. And given the utter collapse of, you know, US-led and European private banking systems, it's no surprise. And these two poles of mainstream thought, pro-state, anti-state, in the most broad terms, are also visible internationally and historically. So, for instance, states like the USSR allowed little to no economic activity to occur outside of the boundaries of the state, whereas the USA has a long tradition of more laissez-faire capitalism. So, to begin with then, a common myth about Marxism is that we line up on the pro-state side of things. This could not be further from the truth. Marxists are not for a strong state on the USSR's model. And Marx and Engels, as well as later Marxists like Lenin and Trotsky, and all of the Marxists in whose tradition we stand, rejected this explicitly. So, for instance, to begin, you know, in the 19th century, under the German Chancellor Bismarck, who was quite conservative, to put it lightly, he massively extended state intervention into production at the expense of private liberal capitalism. At the time, Engels polemicized against those who saw this as some form of state socialism. Later Marxists, like Lenin and Trotsky, believed that the capitalist state needed to be smashed, and their view of socialism, their hypothetical socialist society, would be decentralized, democratic, and ultimately stateless. And as a matter of fact, when Lenin put forward this kind of argument in his pamphlet, The State and Revolution, he was accused of being an anarchist. So, to make it clear, socialist alternative is not in the state-heavy tradition of socialism. We argued throughout the Cold War, and we argue still today, that nations like the USSR, China, Vietnam, North Korea, Cuba are actually state capitalist. And that, So anyway, that more importantly for today's talk, though, isn't the polemics against that that particular tradition. It's more I want to debunk and refute the liberal tradition of the state. This is to say that we reject totally the idea that the state is a neutral body existing above society. Marxism has never regarded the state as above class distinctions, but as the clearest expression of the class distinction. That is to say, in the Marxist worldview, the state is a repressive body which is organised around the interests of the ruling class. Today, the ruling class is capitalist, and so the state we live under, while presenting itself as neutral, is actually a capitalist state. And so that's the whole point of this talk. So the starting point to this argument is pretty obvious, but it's the fact that we live in an utterly class-divided society. And, you know, hopefully don't need to prove this too much to people in this room, but just to give you a bit of a fact, the Australian Bureau of Statistics reported in June 2008 that the share of national income going to wages fell to its lowest level since 1965, and that's 52.4%. So of all of the wealth produced by the working class, only 52.4% goes back to the working class. While that of profits, so the you know, raw profit that the bosses get after production takes place, that accounts for 28.4% of total production. In monetary terms, the average pay of a CEO in a top 100 company in 2007 was $1.83 million. The baseline pay. It should be clear that after bonuses, the average pay of CEOs in those same companies comes to $5.53 million. Australia's highest paid CEO in 2007 was Alan Moss from the Macquarie Bank, which had hitherto been seen as the millionaire's factory, and he earned $33.5 million in 2006. Meanwhile, the unemployment rate, which is massively underreported at any rate, has increased recently to close to 6%, which will leave tens of thousands out of work and at risk of falling into dire poverty. So the unfairness of this setup, and you know, it's even starker if you take a global view, is obvious to anyone, I think. So the simple question is, why don't we just take their money? It's very straightforward. Why don't we just go and get all of their wealth and redistribute it? This would solve so many of the world's problems. So we could go down to Collins Street as a start, and we could liberate some of the more exclusive stores on Collins Street and treat ourselves to a bit of luxury. We could then go to the department stores and requisition all of their goods and distribute them to those that need them the most. We could go to Toorak and kick the bourgeoisie out of their luxury houses and put the homeless people into those houses. We could walk into the banks and demand that the bankers freeze the accounts of anyone with, you know, say over $500,000, that's generous, over $100,000, in their account while we decide how to use that money. While we're there, we'll rip up all mortgages, we'll rip up all credit card debts. We could go further. You know, we could say to all people, everyone that rents houses out, what right do you have to rent out a house? Just because you own this property, you do nothing, yet you profit from it. So the hell with that, all tenants are now house owners. Congratulations. And, you know, really, there's hundreds of other pretty straightforward things we could think of to do, I think, to, you know, rectify the wealth divide. And God knows this would solve so many other social problems at the same time. But things aren't that easy. Why? The state. Basically. So this is to say that the most basic function of the state is to monopolise force and to prevent the lower classes from simply seizing the wealth of the rulers. And this, you know, seems straightforward and obvious. Basically, if we went to do all the things that I said we should just do, we'd all get arrested and thrown into jail. And this is because theft is illegal. But who defines theft? Well, the law defines theft. And it's laid down by Parliament, the legislative wing of the modern state. It's enforced by the courts. The police are the day-to-day enforcers of this law, and, of course, the law protects everyone's. Everyone rights equally. The law is blind, or so they say. So if you're one of the 100,000 and increasing homeless people in Australia, you know, the law protects your property, the clothes on your back, you know, the meagre items you might be lucky enough to own. If, on the other hand, you're an ultra-wealthy shareholder, one of those millionaires I mentioned before, the law protects you just the same. And so from the perspective of the legal system, this is entirely just. From any human perspective, this is inhuman. And examples like this really abound. I mean, they're so common today. The housing crisis in the United States, like this is, you know, an often made point. Since the recession began, there are hundreds of thousands that have been made homeless while their houses become bank property. What is the main thing that stops people moving back into those houses? The fact that the police will come and evict them. And, yeah, like I said, there's hundreds of other examples like that that you could think of worldwide. And so anyway, while we're on the topic of the law, we should take a closer look at the police. Now, according to basically everything, like from children's books to shows like The Bill or Law and Order, whatever, the police exist to protect and serve. That is to say, they save ordinary people from nasty drug dealers and other horrible threats that come from society and all of that. This is a fiction, not least of all because of the Victoria Police's massive involvement in corruption and drug dealing, like they run the operation half the time. Furthermore, the chunk of the murders that are committed and the chunk of assaults that are carried out are carried out by the police. You know, people in this room will probably remember the event that happened towards the end of last year in which four police officers shot and killed, multiply shot and killed, a mentally unstable knife-wielding teenager. And, you know, this is really the kind of cold-blooded murder that Aboriginal Australians have come to expect over the years. You know, a few years ago, the case of Mulrunji Doomadgee, who was savagely beaten and just left to die in his jail cell, that really polarised the nation. And yet, nothing ever comes of it. You know, no cop has ever been convicted for a black death in custody. I mean, this is basically because the police and the courts are structurally racist. They're predicated on the genocide which set up the Australian state. And given that crime rates, this is a more broad point, given that crime rates are always higher in poverty-stricken, disadvantaged areas, police officers quickly become used to beating, harassing and arresting working-class people and people from underprivileged minority backgrounds. You know, or another example, a really clear example of the police's role in society is from the G20 protests that happened last week in London. You know, really representatives of the wealthiest and the worst of humanity came to meet together in London. You know, these are the murderers, these are the thieves. And yet, the police were there to prevent protesters from demonstrating. And on that on those demonstrations, the police assaulted one man who then later collapsed and died of a heart attack as a direct result of his being assaulted. But anyway, the state's monopoly on force goes well beyond just the police. They have an army. Now, ordinarily, this army is reserved for conflicts with other foreign powers. In Australia's case, this means recently Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Australian Army's use in the Asia-Pacific region. And this is always to promote ruling class interests. Australia is just as imperialist as the United States or any other world country. But yet the army is also one of the most important lines of defence of the social order. At the height of the anti-Vietnam protests in the United States, the US Army was used against protesters. And this led to the shooting of four students at the infamous Kent State Massacre. You know, the army similarly has been used in Australia against the working class. And this was the case in 1949 when Labor PM Ben Chifley sent the army in to scab on striking miners. This is one reason why the army is so utterly authoritarian. Soldiers are expected to unquestioningly carry out their orders. Indeed, this type of iron discipline is drilled into new recruits from the moment that they're taken into the army until they're made into obedient machines. Very little terrifies the ruling class more than the idea of their army becoming disloyal. And so in the event that revolution looks like a possibility, the army is almost always one of the last lines of defence for the ruling class. This was famously the case in 1973 in Chile, when General Pinochet overthrew the reformist government of Salvador Allende and he smashed the working class and their organisations. And this type of scenario has been played out in multiple other countries. When seriously threatened, the ruling class is more than willing to drop the veneer of civility that hangs around modern society and use the most brutal state repression to smash the working class. But this said, for the most part, capitalism functions by consent. In other words, in relatively stable liberal democracies, the main thing holding people back from revolution is not immediately military force. Modern capitalism has a whole network of social controls that are largely organised by the state that work together in order to prevent people from fighting back or to neutralise struggles that do occur. Now, this talk isn't where I'm not going to analyse the full extent of bourgeois ideology and the role that plays in stabilising the system. Suffice to say, there are a couple of main points. The first, and this is the underpinning point, it's the lived experience of powerlessness and fragmentation that characterises our day-to-day existence under this system. And this is a material force. This isn't a consciously constructed thing. This is a part of capitalism and the capitalist economy. This lived experience of powerlessness makes us more inclined to respect the power of the state. So this is, a more subtle form of social control that's not created. But that said, other capitalist state institutions draw on this form of social control to reinforce their own social control. And so foremost amongst these mechanisms of social control is the schooling system. And I don't think it's an overstatement to say that the schooling system is utterly oppressive. Students in both primary school and high school are treated like cattle. They're forced to wear uniforms, to submit to arbitrary discipline in the classroom. Students are regularly intimidated by teachers and by school administrations. And, you know, this isn't to blame school teachers. They're workers, part of the working class. But it's to blame an education system that does not orient education around human need as much as it orients education around manufacturing a new generation of working class people. So all of this coercion, conformity and discipline is basically designed to get students used to working class life. You know, you grow up wearing an idiotic uniform sitting in a classroom, bored out of your brains, taking orders from someone you think is a total idiot, to go into a job where you wear an idiotic uniform, sitting somewhere where you're totally bored, taking orders from someone who is a complete idiot. And, you know, to add to all of this, to add insult to injury, is the crap that we're taught at school. And I work as a Year 12 tutor, so, you know, I've got a first-hand experience of the curriculum as it is and as it's shaped. And, you know, let me tell you, it's shaped around being as uncritical of capitalism as is possible. So, for instance, in history, you know, Australians fighting in various imperialist conflicts are always presented as heroes, diggers, and their deaths are glorified. Mythological Australian values are written into almost every historical episode, and all of this is to build a sense of nationalism. Or another example, the genocide of Aboriginal Australians. You know, this does receive a little attention in the classroom, more so than it used to, certainly. But the overwhelming implication is that that was all in the past and everything's fine now. And really, there's no mention of the Northern Territory intervention or the continuing racism that underpins this society. In political studies classes, there's no mention of class or class struggle. You know, there's no sense that reforms that we've won over the years have been won through struggle. You know, political changes are always seen as the product of enlightened parliamentarians, you know, the Gough Whitlams of this world. And different political systems are assessed purely on a legalistic basis, not on any sort of critical basis. Don't get me started about socialism and Marxism and the way they're presented. My God, if they're even presented at all, it's as these outmoded, stodgy, effectively totalitarian ways of seeing the world that are best avoided and, you know, shoved over to the side. And again, none of this is to blame the teachers that teach in classrooms. The reality is they have no control over the curriculum, nor do students. And this fact alone is insane. The two main participants in the education system should have a say over what goes on in the classrooms. Rather, the departments of education, which are responsible only to the government, these bureaucracies, these impersonal bureaucracies that are completely removed from democratic oversight, they are who determine the curriculum. And they're responsible only to the Ministry of Education, whoever that happens to be. And even then, it's, you know, such a cumbersome process to change anything on the curriculum. And this is basically the way in which the ruling class ensures that the next generation are fed pro-capitalist fictions. And, you know, in case you were breathing a sigh of relief, universities aren't any different. By and large, they teach just a slightly more sophisticated version of the kind of ideas that I just went through. And, you know, at any rate, the whole trajectory of higher education in this country at the moment is obviously oriented around neoliberalism and profitability. So, education aside, there are numerous other state-controlled bodies that reinforce social control. The welfare system comes to mind. As I've recently experienced, there's nothing quite so soul-crushing as Centrelink. The unnecessary bureaucracy involved in Centrelink would make the hardest Stalinist blush. Now, this is directed entirely at making working-class life unbearable. It's demoralising to get their paltry, crappy payments, and I don't have the worst of it because I don't have to support a family on the crap that they pay you per fortnight. There are other agencies as well, and so bodies that exert social control over the working class, and utterly undemocratic social control. You know, Connex comes to mind. Like, no matter how much they fuck the public transport system up, they still get contracts, and then they fine us when we don't buy their tickets. There are more examples than just that. But the final aspect of the state's control that I want to go over is its political control over our lives. Even workers' struggle is regulated and managed by the state, and this has been the case in Australia for almost 100 years. Most workers' struggle is illegal. That's the starting point. We don't have the right to strike in this country. You know, striking is only legal in certain specified periods. And unions that organise or sanction wildcat strikes, legal strikes, are subject to immense fines, as are the individual workers that participate. And these restrictions on union militancy, mandatory arbitration, it's called, is not designed to smash unions completely, but to regulate them and to neuter them, to confine them into the capitalist system and to take all of the militancy and the emphasis on rank-and-file struggle out of the question. Now, on a bigger scale, the whole structure of the system attempts to corral attempts for political change into the parliament. And this is a dead end. Despite its appearance as a representative body, Parliament is nothing but a debating chamber for different pro-capitalist perspectives, and it never can be anything otherwise. I mean, to begin with, there's the fact that the electorate is geographically divided, and that this completely ignores class distinctions that exist within electorates. Furthermore, in the system where the media is monolithic and completely privately owned, the debates and discussions around elections, except for rarest exceptions, are almost always determined and defined by different pro-capitalist perspectives. This combined with a two-party system reinforces the slogan, no matter who you vote for, capitalism wins. Additionally, we've got no control over governments once we're elected. You know, if we did, just think about the things that would never have happened. This country would have never participated in the Iraq War. Work choices would never have been passed. And the most decisive thing, however, that subverts the so-called democracy that exists today is the actual existence of the massive class divide. No matter who is in parliament, the ruling class maintains economic power. The working class, on the other hand, is utterly powerless in day-to-day life. The bourgeoisie can easily choose to disinvest from a country, shift its investments elsewhere. They can bring down governments using their wealth and influence. But yet this is rarely necessary. Governments know their fortunes are tied directly to those of the capitalists they represent. The international competitiveness of any economy, any country, is directly tied to the competitiveness of the corporations and within it and their productivity. And furthermore, even the most well-intentioned party, not that these particularly exist, once elected, are constrained by the conservative and bureaucratic inertia of the state apparatuses that I mentioned before. And so, you know, left-wing parties with reformist ambitions have occasionally, historically, been pushed into parliaments by mass movements. They always end up doing one of two things. They moderate their agenda, they make it acceptable to capitalism. This is famously the case in the 1980s with the socialist government of François Mitterrand in France. Or they get overthrown by the capitalist class. This was the case with the Whitlam government here, or with the Allende government that I mentioned before in Chile. And so this is why it's disempowering and conservatizing to orient politically towards the Parliament for Change. And over the years, countless social movements, you know, in their decline, have gone down this path. Starting with the Labour movement, they have always been neutralised and rendered harmless by being corralled into parliamentary avenues. If instead of striking, workers simply and only vote for a representative, they have lost the struggle before it's begun. And the bosses know this, and that's why they're more than happy to put the Labour Party into government. So anyway, I've outlined a number of ways why the state controls the working class. There are other aspects to the modern state. This isn't going to be the emphasis of my talk, obviously, but it's worth saying a few of them. World over, for instance, states control monetary policy. You know, the Reserve Bank's supposedly independent, but everyone knows that's crap. And these guarantees on monetary policy ensure capitalists a stable currency with which to do business. States regulate national borders, controlling imports and exports. They control migration. And this is important for capitalism as it regulates international competition in the labour market. None of this, of course, has any regard whatsoever for human need. You know, strong states, for instance, are often able to force poorer states through a combination of the threat of economic sanctions or the IMF with withholding loans. They're able to force poorer states into disadvantageous free trade agreements that lead to the mass impoverishment of those poorer states. Or immigration policy, similarly, has no regard or interest in human need. Rather, it's structurally racist, designed around fostering a national identity in every country. And insofar as labourers are allowed into a country, you know, it's solely as a commodity, solely because they have skills to offer the economy. Nation states also conduct foreign policy, and this is always set to a backdrop of imperialism. The hard edge of this is obviously war, the soft edge being diplomatic rows that flare up every now and again. So the key is, with all of these aspects of this modern state, is that they have no regard whatsoever for human interest or human life. They all orient around the different priorities and different interests of the world's ruling classes. So this raises the important question, then, of how the bourgeoisie controls the state, because it can sound a little like a conspiracy theory. It's not, I assure you. To pose the question, though, even of how the bourgeoisie controls the state, is almost the wrong way of posing the question. Key to the Marxist understanding is that the state is capitalist. It is bourgeois. As we've seen, every aspect of the state is undemocratic. Every aspect of the state takes ruling class dominance as its inviolable starting point. Every aspect of the state takes the submission of the working class as its starting point. Every aspect of the state is predicated on the sacredness of capital accumulation. That is to say, the state, from the laws that make capitalist private property sacred to industrial relations offices that promote productivity, every aspect of the state is oriented around exploitation and profitability. This fact also explains why state-owned businesses are also capitalist businesses, albeit capitalist businesses without the stereotypical top hat-wearing capitalist. State businesses are just as much locked into the profit-making system as their private counterparts, and they're just as reliant on the exploitation of the working class. So this is, you know, everywhere capitalism is hegemonic. and this applies at a government level. Economic power turns into social and political hegemony. And this is why, you know, your typical idealist reformer who wants to get into the system to change it from within doesn't end up changing the system from within as much as the system ends up changing them, or they're thrown out of it. So the state is structurally capitalist, that's the key. But nonetheless, there are bonds, intimate bonds, between, you know, the private capitalists who run corporations and people in the state. The Labor Party, for instance, reserves seats at its annual conferences for representatives of business groups and major corporations. The lobbying system is well known and well established, as is the system of political donations. This is obviously especially pronounced in the United States, but it's here. This is why parliamentarians are paid so highly. They're expected to mingle with the rich and famous. And so really, the political class at the head of the state, it's another wing of the same class. And yeah, this is perfectly illustrated by someone like Malcolm Turnbull. You know, made his fortune and then decides to try his hand at politics. And, you know, to be blunt about it, the other thing is they go to the same social clubs, they go to the same schools, they share the same world outlook. You know, the different wings of the capitalist class, the political wing and the private wing, are, you know, different wings of the same class. So, to sum up, what conclusions can Marxists learn from this analysis? Broadly speaking, two things. Firstly, the state is a structure made up of many components, yet every component of the state, from the police to the legal system to the education system, is structured and determined by the logic and the needs of capitalism. It is a state designed to protect a minority and oppress and control the majority. This is why it is undemocratic and utterly cut off from the needs of the working class. This is why we cannot hope to capture the state. The state can never be a progressive tool in the hands of the working class, just like a nuclear bomb will never be a tool for peace. No matter who uses it, the state will never be an interest for true justice or socialism. This is why we have to explicitly reject political perspectives such as that of the Greens or the Labor Party, who orient to elections in order to change things. And this leads me to the second point. We need to smash the capitalist state. The army must be dismantled. The police must be disbanded. The courts need to be shut down. The top bureaucrats need to be kicked out of their offices onto the streets. State secrets have to be published and the parliament should be demolished. Or maybe turned into a museum. I don't know. Whatever people want. We have to realise that the whole state apparatus is an obstacle to overthrowing capitalism, which is why we need to bring it crumbling down. This is why we are revolutionary socialists. We are for overthrowing the state. This isn't to say that we're anarchists and that we're not for any form of social organisation. We are for social organisation. We're for creating what's called a workers' state. Now, I don't have much time to talk about what a workers' state would look like, but the basic thing is, Lenin makes this point, it would be a non-state, in that it would be the first social organisation created by a majority, for a majority, run by a majority, and that acts in the interests of humanity. So a workers' state will only be the product of a mass workers' revolution. Therefore, it will be a total negation of the capitalist state that exists today. The beginnings of these workers' states are visible in a whole number of revolutions that have occurred over the 20th century. But again, that's a whole different talk. For the moment, though, we should end just to remembering the state is nothing but a committee for managing the common affairs of the ruling class. And this is why, to use Marx's words, the working class cannot simply lay hold of the ready-made state machinery and wield it for its own purposes. We must smash the capitalist state once and for all, and the only way we can do this is with democratic structures of our own. And that is the Marxist approach to the state.